A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
40 years after it first aired, and the single most recognizable moment in children's television is still a giant baby's head laughing in the sun. Not a lesson, not a moral, not a number. A laughing sun baby. Daniel's prompt this week starts from a very specific place. Ezra is 14 months old, mostly too young for screens, but Daniel has YouTube Kids installed for the desperation clips. Nothing else calms him down. And Daniel's been thinking about his own anchor points. Teletubbies, the Morbegs, Rosie and Jim. Which, as he points out, may explain why he still gravitates toward entertainment. That's delightfully weird. His long-term ambition with Creative AI is to build a children's series around a family of sloths living in Jerusalem. And his questions are about the field itself. Is there a community of animators, scriptwriters, directors, and creatives who specifically work in this genre? Have theories and references emerged about the point and direction of children's programming? And is there actual discourse and criticism around what gets made for children today?
And he lands on the real tension before he even asks the question. Some programming is didactic, education first, carrying a worldview. Other programming is creative, weird, built for inhabiting rather than instructing. He gravitates toward the creative. So we went looking for the people who make this stuff and what they think they're doing.
The answer is that they've been fighting about this for 60 years. And the fight is visible in every frame of every show.
Children's television is a multi-billion dollar global industry that runs on radically different theories of what a child actually needs. And those theories aren't hidden. They're encoded in the pacing, the color palette, the sound design, the character design, the narrative structure. You can watch 90 seconds of a show and usually tell which philosophy built it. It's like looking at a building and knowing whether the architect believed in ornament or function. The philosophy is in the bones.
The didactic tradition treats television as a tool. Childhood is a developmental project. The adult knows what the child needs, and the screen is there to deliver it. Letters, numbers, pro-social behavior, emotional regulation. The creative tradition treats childhood as a state worth inhabiting. Nonsense has value. Rhythm has value. The child's own pleasure is the point. The screen is a place, not a tool.
And the field is understudied. David Buckingham, the media scholar, has done serious work on Teletubbies specifically, and he's one of the few who has. Compared to film studies or adult television studies, children's television gets a fraction of the academic attention, which is strange, because it's the most watched genre in most people's lives. Almost everyone passes through it. Almost nobody studies it. It's like if nobody studied sleep, because everyone does it.
Daniel's instinct is correct. This is a genre of literature. It's just one that most critics stop watching when they turn 8.
To understand the didactic and creative split, you have to go back to the two shows that defined it, Sesame Street and Teletubbies.
Sesame Street was born in 1969 out of the Children's Television Workshop, and it was explicitly designed by educational psychologists. The war on poverty was the context. The idea was that television could close the educational gap for disadvantaged children before they even got to school. Every segment was tested. Every character had a pedagogical function. The count teaches numbers. Oscar teaches emotional tolerance, sort of. The whole thing was a delivery system for curriculum. Think about the structure of the show. It was built like a classroom with commercial breaks, short segments, clear objectives, measurable outcomes.
And it worked. The evidence on early Sesame Street is strong. Kids who watched it entered school with better letter and number recognition. The show became the template for what educational children's television was supposed to be. The didactic tradition has been living off that legitimacy for 50 years. And to be fair, it earned that legitimacy. The show was a genuine intervention. It did what it set out to do.
But the worldview embedded in it's specific, and Daniel named it childhood as preparation, media as instrument, the adult knows best, and the values aren't neutral. Sesame Street taught sharing and kindness and tolerance, which are values, not facts. The didactic frame just makes them feel like facts.
Then in 1997, the BBC launches Teletubbies, Anne Wood and Andrew Davenport, and they rejected the entire didactic frame. Their starting question wasn't what children need to learn. It was what pre-verbal children actually enjoy. And the answer they came up with was rhythm, repetition, nonsense sounds, physical comedy, bright colors, and a giant sun with a laughing baby's face.
The show was designed for 1 and 2 year olds, the exact age that didactic television had completely ignored, because the video deficit effect means children under 2 don't learn much from screens anyway. So what's television actually for at that age? The didactic tradition had no answer. Teletubbies said, pleasure, inhabiting, weirdness.
And the critics lost their minds. The show was attacked for dumbing down children. American broadcasters initially refused to air it. There were newspaper columns, academic critiques, moral panic. The objection wasn't that the show failed to teach. The objection was that it refused to try. It was unapologetically not educational, and that was seen as a kind of betrayal. As if children's television had one job and Teletubbies had walked off the site.
Which is exactly what Anne Wood intended. She said the show was for an audience that couldn't tell you what it wanted, so she had to watch them. And what she saw was that very young children love repetition. They love when the same thing happens again and again. They love nonsense words. They love physical pratfalls. The show was built from observation, not curriculum.
And here's the thing. The video deficit effect, which we've talked about before, actually supports the Teletubbies approach. Children under 2 learn less from screens than from live interaction. That's a robust finding in developmental psychology. So if a screen can't teach a 1-year-old much anyway, the didactic project at that age is mostly theater for the parents. The creative project is the one that's honest about what the medium can do.
Daniel's other anchor points are from the same British public service tradition. The Morbegs aired in 1987 on the BBC, Rosie and Jim in 1990. Neither show was required to produce measurable learning outcomes. The Morbegs was a surreal puppet show about creatures living under a castle that barely makes sense to adults. Rosie and Jim was about a rag doll and a cat on a canal boat. Both were commissioned because the BBC had a mandate to make programming for children, full stop, not programming that would improve test scores, programming that would exist.
And that's the public service broadcasting model. It funded weirdness without requiring a demonstrable return. The commercial market almost never does that. The American system, which is largely commercial, has always leaned didactic because didactic content is easier to sell to parents. You can put letters on the box. You can say this show will teach your child to read. Weirdness has no box copy.
I'll defend the Morbegs to the end. The burning tree in that show is a Rorschach test. It reveals more about the adult watching than the show itself. But that's the point. It wasn't for adults. It was for children. And children don't need things to make sense in the way adults do.
The worldview question is the deep one. Didactic programming embeds a philosophy. Childhood is preparation. Media should be instrumental. The adult knows what the child needs. Creative programming embeds the opposite. Childhood is a state worth inhabiting. Nonsense has value. The child's own pleasure is the point. And neither of these is neutral. They're both arguments about what a child is.
Daniel said education and values can come from home and later education. Childhood is a time to be fun and have a ridiculous, fictitious world. That's a coherent position. It's also a minority position in the industry because the industry's customers are parents and parents are anxious. Didactic content sells anxiety relief. Creative content sells what, exactly? Delight? Delight is a harder sell.
But here's where it gets interesting. The creative tradition has been winning commercially for the last few years. Bluey is the proof.
Bluey, from the Australian Broadcasting Corporation, is the creative tradition's commercial vindication. It's a show about a family of dogs playing imaginative games. The emotional truth is the point. The parents aren't idiots. The children aren't being taught letters. The show trusts its audience to feel things. And parents watch it with their kids because it's actually good.
Bluey is the show that broke the assumption that children's television has to be either educational or empty. It's neither. It's art. And it's the most watched children's show in the world in several markets. The commercial success of Bluey is the strongest argument the creative tradition has ever had. And it happened in the marketplace, not in a funding committee. Parents chose it, repeatedly, in large numbers.
And then there's Cocomelon, which is the didactic tradition's dark mirror. Cocomelon originated on YouTube in 2006 and later moved to Netflix. It's produced using data analytics on what holds toddler attention. The colors, the pacing, the camera movements, the song structures. Everything is optimized for engagement. There's no artistic intent. There's no worldview. There's just the algorithm.
Parents describe it as a digital pacifier. It works. The child goes quiet, but nothing is happening. It's the television equivalent of empty calories. The show isn't trying to teach anything, and it's not trying to say anything. It's just trying to hold attention, which is a third philosophy, actually. Not didactic, not creative. Instrumental in the worst sense.
And that's the discourse today. Bluey versus Cocomelon. The creative tradition versus the engagement algorithm. Parents argue about this constantly. The screen time anxiety is the backdrop. Parents want quality content, but quality is hard to define, and the platforms don't help, because the platforms just want watch time.
So if the creative tradition has this lineage, from Teletubbies to Bluey, who actually makes this stuff today, and what's happening to them?
The community exists and is more organized than Daniel might expect. The Children's Media Association is the main professional body. The Writers Guild of America has a children's writing track. There's a named fellowship, the Fred Rogers Writers Neighborhood, which signals exactly where the didactic tradition's institutional power still sits. Fred Rogers was the gentle didactic tradition's saint. The fellowship named after him trains writers to make educational content.
And there's the Creator Society, which is more about the independent production side. These are real institutions. People have careers in this. They go to conferences. They have awards. The community isn't scattered. It's just invisible to most adults because adults don't watch the credits.
But how does someone actually enter that community? If Daniel wanted to find these people, where would he start?
The answer is less straightforward than it used to be. The traditional route was through the BBC training schemes, or through a children's writing fellowship, or through working your way up in a production company. Those routes still exist, but they're narrower than they were. The streaming contraction has closed a lot of doors. The people who are getting in now are often coming through independent animation, through YouTube, through small production houses that take risks on new voices.
And the industry is in crisis, though. The streaming contraction has hit children's television hard. Kidscreen's Industry Outlook reports reduced commissioning, shorter runs, and a flight to familiar IP. The platforms are cutting back on original children's content because it's expensive and the audience churns. A kid will watch the same episode of Bluey 40 times. You don't need 40 episodes.
And the flight to safety is the problem for the creative tradition. Familiar IP means reboots, spin-offs, established brands. Weird, culturally specific, original ideas are the first thing cut when budgets tighten. The Morbegs wouldn't get commissioned today. Neither would Teletubbies. The system that produced them no longer exists.
Which is the context for Daniel Sloth Project. The Sloth family in Jerusalem, the creative tradition has a lineage he can join, from Teletubbies to Bluey. But the industry's current risk aversion means a weird, culturally specific show would likely need an indie production route, a streaming platform willing to take a chance, or a public service broadcaster. And the AI angle is novel. No one has yet figured out what AI-generated children's content does to the didactic and creative axis.
Daniel's approach with creative AI is interesting because he's coming at it from the creative side. He's not trying to optimize engagement, he's trying to build a world, a family of sloths in Jerusalem. That's a creative vision. The question is whether the tools will let him realize it without the institutional backing that the creative tradition used to have.
There's a deeper question there. If the tools let anyone make a children's show, what happens to the curation function? The BBC used to be the gatekeeper. Enwood's intuition was the filter. Now, the filter is the algorithm, and the algorithm optimizes for watch time, not for what Ann Wood would have called delight.
The criticism landscape is thin, but real. Buckingham and a handful of others have treated children's television as a site of cultural struggle over what childhood should be. Practitioners debate whether the industry has a responsibility to educate or merely to not harm. Parents' discourse is dominated by screen time anxiety and the search for quality, but the academic field remains small. Daniel is right that it's understudied.
The video deficit effect matters here too. If children under 2 don't learn from screens, then the didactic project for that age group is mostly about making parents feel better. The creative project, the Teletubbies project, is about giving the child something to inhabit. And at 14 months, Ezra is exactly at the age where the creative tradition says, just show him something weird and wonderful. He's not going to learn letters. He might learn that the world is strange and funny.
Which is a legitimate thing to learn.
It is. And it's the thing Daniel learned from the Morbegs and Rosie and Jim and the Teletubbies. He learned that entertainment can be delightfully weird. That's a value. It shaped his adult taste. The didactic tradition would have taught him letters. The creative tradition taught him that nonsense is worth loving.
I'd argue that's the more important lesson. Letters he was going to learn anyway. The appetite for weirdness had to be planted.
Here's the second order thing. The didactic tradition assumes the adult knows what the child needs. But the creative tradition assumes the child knows something the adult has forgotten. Anne Wood watched children to figure out what they liked. She didn't consult a curriculum. She consulted the audience. That's a fundamentally different relationship between maker and viewer.
The didactic tradition is top-down. The creative tradition is observational. And the engagement algorithm is neither. It's just a feedback loop with no one at the controls. Cocomelon doesn't observe children. It measures them. The difference matters.
Which is a good moment to bring in someone who's been sitting on a very specific piece of Teletubbies trivia for 25 years.
I hand-washed Tinky Winky's handbag.
I'm sorry.
1998. I was a runner on a Teletubbies adjacent production. 4 months fetching tea for the costume department. One afternoon, the bag came back from an outdoor shoot covered in mud, and the costume supervisor told me to wash it by hand. It was the most careful I've ever been with an object that wasn't mine.
What was the set actually like?
Surreal. The actors inside the suits couldn't see or hear properly. The director shouted directions through earpieces they could barely make out. Half the time, they just moved and hoped. The production team had no idea whether the show would work. They were making it up as they went along. The research was mostly Anne Wood's intuition about what babies found funny.
The most analyzed children's show of its generation was built on guesswork.
The famous bit, the baby in the sun, the laugh, the giggle, that was a mistake. The baby's mother said something off camera to encourage her child. The mic picked it up. The editors loved it so much, they kept it. The show's most iconic moment was an accident.
That's the creative tradition in one anecdote. You can't plan the thing that works. You can only set up the conditions and recognize it when it happens.
I still have the handbag. Well, not the handbag. A photo of the handbag. The actual bag went back to the BBC, but I kept the photo. It's in a box somewhere.
The accidental giggle becoming the show's signature is the strongest possible argument against the didactic frame. The thing that worked wasn't designed. It was noticed.
That's the thing the engagement algorithm can't do. It can measure what worked. It can't notice it. Noticing requires a person who cares.
The tea was terrible, too. The whole production ran on bad tea and guesswork. Somehow, it became the most watched children's show on Earth.
There's something almost comforting about that. The most iconic children's show of its generation was held together by bad tea and a lucky accident. It suggests the creative tradition doesn't require perfect conditions. It just requires someone paying attention.
The misconception most people hold about children's television is that it's low stakes. Unserious, no artistic ambition. The reality is that it's a site of genuine cultural struggle over what childhood should be. The philosophies embedded in different shows are radically different, and they have consequences for how millions of children experience their first years.
The second misconception is that educational is inherently better. The didactic tradition embeds a specific worldview. Childhood is preparation, television is tool. That's non-neutral. The creative tradition argues that nonsense and weirdness and pleasure have their own developmental value, and the commercial success of Bluey suggests the audience agrees.
The open question is what AI does to this axis. If AI makes children's content cheaper and easier to produce, does the creative tradition get a new set of tools? Or does the algorithmic pressure toward engagement metrics simply create a new, more insidious didacticism? A didacticism that doesn't even pretend to teach anything, just to hold attention.
That's the thing Daniel is walking into. The creative tradition has room for him. A sloth family in Jerusalem is exactly the kind of weird, culturally specific, world-building project that the tradition exists to support. The question is whether the industry does. And right now, the industry is running scared.
But the tools have changed. A motivated solo creator can now produce a 7-minute kids animation in about a month. That was impossible 5 years ago. The institutional gatekeepers are weaker than they've ever been, which means the creative tradition might not need the BBC anymore. It might just need Daniel and a good idea and enough time.
The through line is that children's television is understudied precisely because it's dismissed as just for kids. But it may be the purest side of cultural struggle over what childhood is for. Everyone watches it. Almost no one thinks about it. Daniel is thinking about it. Andy's got a sloth family in Jerusalem to build.
Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop.
This has been My Weird Prompts.
Email us at show@myweirdprompts.com.
We'll be back soon.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.